I think fundamentally, if you split the packages, maybe there's a little more transparency and honesty in this thing. Cordero, at the very least, from what I understand from multiple sources, was seriously considering pushing that potential, which obviously was not something MLS and Soccer United Marketing were going to tolerate conversation about. So Cordero's gone. They've got Wilson as the CEO, and I don't think that there's any threat of that happening now, right? Now I think they're safe.
Welcome back. You're listening to the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast about watching soccer on TV and online. Welcome to episode 168. Coming up on this week's show, news about a soccer streaming service that has bit the dust. US soccer gets a bailout from the government despite huge cash surplus. Premier League goes all in on FIFA 20 tournaments. Our thoughts on Major League Soccer's EMLS debut. And we've got news about beIN Sports threatening the Premier League. We'll tell you why. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, alongside Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, I was thinking about this yesterday. It's been 6 weeks. 6 weeks ago, I remember speaking to my wife, saying like, hey, I'm not sure if I should be going down to South Florida this weekend to go to Inter Miami's first home game, the first MLS game in South Florida in 19 years that I've been waiting. And really then we started to really understand and get hit by the coronavirus in terms of the threat of it in the United States and seeing what was happening in Italy. It's hard to believe, Kartik, it's been 6 weeks. Really, without soccer, you know, what you've been up to stay safe and healthy and sane this past week?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've just kind of accepted it as a new normal. And I'd be honest, it has given me an opportunity the last week to watch an extraordinary amount of international football, old international football, and really kind of appreciate the tactics and the tactical evolution of the sport. And that's kind of coincided with me. And this is the thing that's interesting, and Jonathan Wilson always points this out, even though we tend to kind of see and talk and discuss about tactical changes during club football, the tactical evolution tends to come around international tournaments. And it's something, as someone who favors club football over international football, or at least claims to, I've always pushed back on. But then I'm watching 6, I'm watching 10, I'm watching 14, and I'm watching the Euros from 2000 and 2004, and I'm seeing what Wilson's talking about. So it's been actually pretty fascinating. As a companion, I've been reading David Goldblatt's latest book, The Era of Football, and in classic Goldblatt fashion, he weaves together elements of politics, society, culture, and of course, football. And it's essentially a successor to The Ball Is Round. It picks up really kind of picks up with that Euro 2000 final with France and Italy, and you know, goes around the world. There's a lot more on the United States in this book than there was in The Ball Is Round, because I think the last 20 years, and there's a lot on the women's game, and the women's game tends to revolve or has historically revolved around the U.S. There's been more impact from the U.S. in the global game over the last 20 years, at least from Goldblatt's reading, than elsewhere.
Just for a second, it's funny you say that too, because, and this is a coincidence, but we didn't plan this at all. But I've been rereading David Goldblatt's book, The Ball Is Round. And I remember getting it many Christmases ago, and I remember – it's a big book. I remember reading it, but I remember not finishing it because it was just – even life got too busy, and I had to put it to the side, and I don't think I ever finished it. So actually, this past week, I've been reading it, and there's one of the early chapters in the book. It's almost as if the filmmakers who did The English Game by Netflix said, okay, let's go ahead and actually take this chapter – and let's make this into The English Game, the series on Netflix, because it is, I mean, play by play, I mean, exactly what this film is all about.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, the thing about Goldblatt is when he wrote The Ball Is Round, I think we didn't, it was a brilliant book. but we didn't quite appreciate his grasp of greater issues around football. So you're right. The English Game, I think, was lifted entirely from almost entirely from his book, although you could also argue there have been some other historical books about the FA Cup that have been written, or FA Cup specifically, that they may have been taken from. But then he wrote the book before the 2010 World Cup. Or sorry, the 2014 World Cup about Brazil. And that was colorful and really enjoyed that read. Then he wrote the book about the Premier League. And the Premier League book that he wrote, talking about TV money and Premier League owners watching the NFL, which I think is a theme we've seen in a couple books, right? There have been a couple mm-hmm. books written about the early days of the Premier League and how it was inspired by the NFL. And David Dean was a Miami Dolphins fan, I think, and yep. went to a Dolphins game and all of that stuff. And Lord Sugar was watching the NFL. But what Goldblatt was able to do was kind of weave societal and historical happenings in England and Thatcherism and Blairism into that book. Then now in this new book, Age of Football, he's done that for the whole world. It's really quite brilliant. I'm a little more than halfway through the book. I'm to the point where he's talking about the divide between Catalonia and Castile and Madrid and Barcelona. And of course, having read Sid Lowe's great book on La Liga, and Sid Lowe, if those of you who don't know, was a political writer before he was a football writer. So he's uniquely qualified to write a book like that. But the same themes are coming back up. And you're seeing in him talk about how prior to 2008, when they won the Euros, there was a Catalonian resentment of the national team. Now, actually, Sid Lowe's book is about La Liga, right? It's about club football. This, he's talking specifically about the national team. But then eventually you had, when they win the World with the Euros, not quite in eight, it wasn't – Catalonians weren't quite embracing the national team at that point, the Spanish national team. But 8 and 10 and 12, when they win the – especially 12 when they win the Euros, because we're now really far into the cycle, the same celebrations you saw in Valencia or Malaga or even Madrid you would see in Barcelona in the streets. And he said that that was like a great moment for Catalonian integration into the greater nation. And then the next few years, Spain – falls off internationally, and then Catalonia is trying to push for independence again. So not that it's necessarily related, but that that's how what he does in his writing, which is so brilliant. The other thing I wanted to mention is, and I know you finished it, I have not yet. I was actually intending to finish it yesterday, but got kind of ill, kind of sinusy, and then I'm fine this morning, but went to bed early. The Puma versus Adidas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is a German movie, Adidas versus Puma, German movie in German, done on which is on Amazon Prime. It was really good the first hour. I have not watched the rest of it. I know you've watched it, and this was a coincidence. We didn't plan this. I started watching it, and then you said, "Oh, I've already watched it." So
yeah.
No spoilers, please.
Yeah, no spoilers here. It's Adidas versus Puma, the brothers feud. And like Kartik mentioned, it's in German, but it has closed captioning on Amazon Prime Video. So if you have Amazon Prime Video or Amazon Prime, it's free to watch. And with the closed captioning, you can have it in English. And I'd recommend it. It's really good. I've always been an Adidas fan in terms of admirer of Adidas, the brand and the style and the clothing. And you know, when I was a kid, I was wearing Adidas, and I've always kind of leaned to Adidas. I have a lot of admiration for Puma, but it's just fascinating the true life story of how Adidas was formed and how Puma was formed and the relationship between the family that owned those companies. So definitely recommend watching that one. No spoilers, but that's if you're a soccer fan. If you're a soccer fan and you're listening to this podcast, David Goldblatt's stories and books are recommended, and this movie is too. It just fits right into learning more about or appreciating more the history of soccer and everything around it.
One thing I want to point out is that 2DNA has been showing old Euro finals. I picked up on it when they showed France, Italy, because that was a particular favorite of mine. Chris Whittingham, who has been on this show and obviously works for 2DNA, says they started with 88 with the Netherlands final, Netherlands Soviet Union final. So would have loved to have seen that, missed it, unfortunately. This is really interesting for me because we never saw these matches proper on American television. Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were scrambling to find them. So
well, some of these were on pay-per-view. I mean, if you remember 2004 was on pay-per-view, I think.
I remember going to like three different places to try and find this Portugal-Greece final, which I now have watched properly in my bedroom in the last 24 hours from 2DNA. And I ended up getting to a place that did have it. Which I think was the Lion and Eagle in Boca, around the 40th minute. I mean, it was crazy. People weren't showing this. And there was even a British pub who told me earlier in the tournament that this is the one by Lockhart where Inter Miami is going to play, where the Four Lauderdale Strikers played, where the Fusion played, that it was a NASCAR race day and they couldn't show it. They would normally show football, but not that day. And that is actually the place I'd gone to see the 1999 League One, or what was it called then, Division Two final between City and Gillingham, which got Manchester City promoted back to the second flight. And quite honestly, if that game hadn't happened the way it happened, Tony Pulis was managing Gillingham, by the way. The whole rest of the history of Manchester City might not have happened. They were showing NASCAR, Chris, instead of England-France, which was a group stage game. And obviously, Wayne Rooney got hurt in that tournament. We remember that. But this has kind of been really neat for me to be able to watch these matches in proper. And I think they're showing every final through 12, which was obviously Spain, Italy.
Yeah, I'm looking at the 2DNA press. No, it's not a press release. It's a press release, I guess. I got from them this week, and it's actually hard to keep on up to date on everything that's going on in terms of reruns, because there are actually most broadcasters are doing reruns. Some are getting the word out better than others. But this one is one. So 2DNA. So what they're having is every weekday at noon Eastern time, they're having replays of all Champions League finals. And then at 1 p.m., the action continues with a collection of the best European Championship finals, including Spain's back-to-back finals against Germany and Italy on Thursday and Friday, respectively. So we're recording this on Thursday. Probably most people won't get a chance to listen to this pod and find out about the Spain-Germany final, but Friday does have Spain against Italy in the Euro Championships. So, yeah, definitely a good tip there, Kartik.
The thing that I find so interesting now, watching the Ray Hoggle, Ray Hoggle, of course, he was the main figure and he's a manager, but the Germany, I'm thinking Ray Hoggle with Germany, the Greece-Portugal final, Chris, and then watching multiple games from the 2006 World Cup that FIFA has done in their World Cup at home, most notably France versus Brazil. You're seeing how the low block that Greece played then influenced the tactics in the low block Greece played in 2004, then influenced the tactics of the 2006 World Cup, where you're getting formations that put three or four guys in the midfield to try and break that down. And in the case of France, what was particularly interesting was seeing how good Makélélé was and how that allowed Vieira to have kind of a freer role than he had in 98 or 2002 for France, or even in the Euros in 2004, although Makélélé was kind of hitting his apex in 2004. The World Cup at home, let me just mention this real quickly. This is something FIFA's doing. They're airing FIFA.com is doing. They're airing previous World Cup games, both women's and men's World Cup. So I've seen a couple of U.S. women's World Cup matches, the England game from last year, the Germany game from 2015, among others, during this thing. They're airing it on YouTube with the international feed, but then also at halftime, they're doing these kind of promotional things for the WHO, which have been cool, which have had Gary Lineker, Wayne Rooney, Arsene Wenger, El-Hajj Diouf, you know, all these people, all these figures from around football, Oliver Kahn, in their language. It's funny, everybody did it in their native language, except for Jose Mourinho, who did his in English, but which probably shouldn't surprise us, right? You know, he's but they, giving these like health announcements and promoting the WHO, which I think has been cool, especially at a time when the WHO is under assault here in the U.S. But real quickly, some of the games that you can see on there: Netherlands, Brazil in 2010. This is another fantastic game, and really kind of opened our eyes to that the fact that Brazil, I think, had slipped. I think in 2006 we thought it was an aberration, and then they come back and win the Copa in 2007. Germany, Mexico from the most recent World Cup, which I know is a favorite of a lot of people. USA, Germany from 2015, great game. Carly Lloyd's masterpiece, a game I think going into it we thought that Germany were the better team. Germany, England 2010, which is of course the thing that stuns me about this game was, I guess I had completely forgotten, other than the Lampard non-allowed goal, which was clearly over the line, the course of the match. Germany dominated until England scored, Matthew Upson scored a goal, and then literally a minute later, Lampard should have had a second. Then England was really good for like the next 30 minutes after that disallowed goal, and then after that, Germany just took them apart again. For whatever reason, I had remembered the game oppositely. England was in it, and then that disallowed goal, they were dispirited. That actually wasn't the case. Spain-Netherlands 2014, brilliant, brilliant game. And my observation from this also is it reminded me what an impact, as great as Robin was at Chelsea and at Real Madrid, what an impact Louis van Gaal had on his career and how he went from being a really good player to like a world elite top 10 player because of van Gaal, first at Bayern and then with the Dutch team. And then, of course, the Tournament of Nations game, which U.S. soccer showed between Brazil and the U.S. from 2017, the great U.S. comeback, U.S. women's comeback. And Chris, this reminded me, during the course of every World Cup cycle recently, or the last two cycles where the U.S. has ended up winning the World Cup, there have been significant doubts about the U.S.'s competitiveness about midway through the cycle. And in 2013, a coach was sacked. In 2017, Jill Ellis was very, very close to being sacked, and there's still people who think maybe she would have been sacked if the men's team hadn't blown up so badly. U.S. soccer didn't want to replace both coaches in rapid succession, but just reminds us that World Cup cycles are cycles, and oftentimes it's the team that's peaking at the tournament that wins it. It's not necessarily the team that's been the best during the 4 years, because I think especially the last 4 years, we could very clearly say at times the Netherlands were better than the U.S. or France was better than the U.S., but the U.S. ended up winning the World Cup again and beat both those teams.
So all of these that you mentioned, Kartik, are available for free on YouTube. So again, correct, check out the FIFA YouTube channel for the daily games. And also the last one you mentioned too is US Soccer. Check out their YouTube channel. And it's great to see, Kartik. There's been a lot of, I think almost every major club, or even, not even major club, but every club is doing something. So yesterday, for example, just as one example, Swansea City, my club, was replaying the Swansea Bradford League Cup final in its entirety.
Oh wow!
So every day, most clubs are doing something. You mean there's some content out there? So some great recommendations from you, Kartik, there too. So for me, it's been a little bit different. So from now, when we're recording this podcast, Kartik, in about 2 weeks, the Bundesliga, knock on wood, if everything goes according to plan, is scheduled to come back and start playing games behind closed doors, which is not going to be exciting, but they are talking about bringing in, piping in audio crowd noise, which is something we talked about when we watched those games 6 weeks ago now. Games played behind closed doors, but you just couldn't hear anything. It was just, all you could hear was the players on the field, and there was no atmosphere. So I think that's a good step by the Bundesliga. The Premier League is also discussing the same thing too, piping in crowd noise until fans can return. But the thing about that, though, Kartik, to me is that, yeah, you can have crowd noise, but you need to be able to control that. So if it's a quiet spell in the game, you need to kind of have the crowd noise kind of get a little bit quieter. If it's a fever pitch kind of pinball situation with the ball back and forth in the goal mouth and hits a crossbar, comes off, hits a player, another shot, you need to build up that atmosphere to a crescendo. So
yeah,
hopefully they'll be able to do stuff to that level, just to really get the viewer And the players too. This has an impact on the players. So that's 2 weeks away. So in the meantime, what I've been watching this past week, you've gone down the route of watching a lot of classic matches. I've gone down the route of watching a lot of FIFA 20 games. So I watched Ben Wilmot, who used to play for Watford, now plays for Swansea. He was involved in the lockdown FIFA competition. So I watched Swansea against Bolton. Bolton had Harry Brockbank playing. So, but they're both playing live FIFA 20 on the PS4, and you're watching the game. So it's Swansea against Bolton. And it was really good. I enjoyed it.
Speaking of video games, Ben Wilmot is a great Football Manager signing because he's a young player. You can sign him relatively cheap. I mean, I had to give Swansea more money than I wanted to. But he's actually, if you're playing for multiple years, you can get him at a young age, and he's a center back. He's versatile enough you can play him at fullback. And he's a guy you can keep for 5 to 7 years at least. So funny you mention him and video games, because he's a guy I think of also.
And in real life, he's a great player too. So and actually at FIFA, he's really good too. So there's been several clubs involved, including Scunthorpe, West Ham, Liverpool, and others. And they're right near the final. It's, I think maybe this weekend they're going into the final. So if you're interested in that one, check out Lockdown FIFA on Twitter. Just search for that there, and you'll find that one. And actually, donations, they're encouraging people to make donations that go to the NHS. So that's a very UK-driven competition. Then this past Sunday night, I watched EMLS's debut on Fox Sports 1. And this one, they had a bunch of games on there. Cincinnati against Chicago, LA Galaxy against LAFC, and then they had the final with the winners of those two games. And I enjoyed it. It was exciting. I liked watching it. I was the issue I have with it is just the way that it's produced. So it's so fast. The game of FIFA 20, the video game, is so fast-paced anyway that for a commentator, it's really difficult to commentate a game like that because it moves so quickly. There's a lot more goals than in a normal game. So this one, you had Stu Holden doing the commentary, Mike LaBelle, who's a famous FIFA video game player, he was doing the co-commentary. And then you had Rachel Bonetta doing the sideline reporting, essentially. And it was just too fast-paced. So Stu Holden was trying to keep up with the commentary. And when you go fast, it's just, there's no pause. You mean the commentary wasn't... I would have loved to have had John Strong doing the commentary on that, and then having Stu Holden perhaps doing the color commentary, and then Mike LaBelle maybe at halftime as the FIFA video game analyst giving his thoughts. And Rachel Bonetta, I love Rachel. She's so entertaining, so funny. I don't think it's just too many people involved. And Rachel maybe should go on and do something else soccer related for Fox. But this one's probably not a great fit for her in this present, the way it's produced. In the LA Galaxy LAFC game, you had Chicharito playing. So you had, it was interesting because you had Chicharito and I think Diomande from LAFC playing. So you'd have video of them in their homes playing the game. And then on the same screen, you'd see the actual game happening. The only issue with that, though, too, which was really actually fun to see that, though, is that they were mic'd up. So you would hear them talking to themselves through the game. And at the same time, you had Stu Holden doing his commentary. And then you'd have the co-com from Mike LaBelle. So it was just too many voices sometimes. And it was just people talking over each other. But all in all, it was entertaining. I would watch it again. I think it's going on this weekend again on FS1. And I think it's maybe this weekend's the final week. I'm not sure. But the next round, it will be happening this weekend. So check that out. And... that's about it, Kartik, in terms of my... I've already talked about...
I'll be honest with you, I didn't watch this, but Rachel Bonetta could actually do play-by-play. She's done that before, and she's been okay.
Yeah.
So I kind of like... Look, I mean, and even when it comes to... And I was talking to a friend about this yesterday. Even when it comes to news anchors and people who present, I tend to like bubbly, enthusiastic people, which may be why I like both Holden and Twellman so much. Rachel Bonetta conveys that to me, even going back to when she used to do like these videos for MLS, for the MLS website in way back when. So I think actually for an event like this, she'd probably be really good as the main commentator.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. It's Rachel, I don't know. I just think possibly. I mean, to commentate is difficult anyway. To commentate FIFA video games is going to be even more difficult. And I don't know. I'm sure there's a spot there for her someplace, but it's so rare these days that she does any soccer coverage. So it was good to have her on. And Rachel, we've been a big fan of since the beginning, since she was early days of, I think, Toronto FC, when she was one of the main video people there too. And when she started off at MLS, or I think, yeah, it was MLS, I think it was, or Kick TV, way before she went to Fox.
Yeah, Kick TV is what it was, right.
Right.
Yeah, I said MLS website, but it was Kick TV.
So, so that's about it from my watching. So in comparison, I guess you've got, also actually, the Premier League had their EPL Invitational, so they had their FIFA video game competition this week too, which will continue. And that one's on the NBC Sports app. That one's also, I think, on, what is it, Twitter, the Premier League Twitter's account, the Premier League Facebook account. So you've got the Premier League doing one, you got Liga MX doing one, you got MLS doing one.
I believe Telemundo Deportes has shown.
Yep, that's true.
Has shown it, even though NBCSN hasn't, although they will this weekend, I believe. But
yeah.
Telemundo, it's been more accessible on Spanish television than on English language television.
It's true. Yeah, it's true. So we have the full schedule of all the MLS, Liga MX, and Premier League games that are being played on FIFA 20, which is so surreal, on our main website, on worldsoccertalk.com, on the homepage. So you can check out if you want to watch any of those games. At this point, it's fun to watch. I just think it could be produced better. And part of the issue, too, is there's technical issues. You mean in terms of bandwidth, in terms of just the delay, in terms of just lag, like games being laggy. But, you mean, they're doing the best they can. All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah, and the big one that I think everybody is talking about, which is the Newcastle United situation. BN Sports has written letters to all 20 Premier League clubs to warn them of the dangers of Saudi Arabia buying Newcastle United, a government that flaunts piracy. So let's kind of reset this for a lot of the listeners who might forget this. 2017, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, among other countries, begin a blockade of Qatar, which is in their neighborhood, right? So an economic blockade. 2018, the World Cup rolls around. beIN Sports is the rights holder in the Middle East, North Africa territory for FIFA, right? So we have something called Be Out Q. Am I right? Is that, that's what it's called,
yep,
right?
That's right.
Be Out Q. Be Out Q, which the Saudi government pushes, which is piracy, which allows essentially people in that region where the rights are held and beIN Sports has, in their mind, paid a very high rights fee to FIFA to be the exclusive broadcaster in that region. There is piracy going on with the broadcast of that 2018 FIFA World Cup. It then has expanded beyond that to other things that beIN Sports, again from Qatar, has the rights to in football, Be Out Q being, of course, Saudi. Now, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is controlled by the Saudi government, so it's essentially a government government takeover, appears to have been close to reaching a deal or signing a deal with Mike Ashley. This has been rumored for months, but with Mike Ashley to take over Newcastle United. Now, let's not forget that both the UAE and Qatar – essentially own football clubs themselves in Manchester City for UAE and Qatar for PSG for Qatar. However, the way this is explained legally to me, Chris, there's a little more of a separation in the ownership and the way the ownership portfolio was held for PSG and Man City than there would be for Newcastle. Newcastle's almost more directly. The Saudis haven't gone through the process of saying, okay, this member of the royal family has their own independent holdings, and in their own independent holdings, they're buying Manchester City or PSG. It's actually directly from the Saudi sovereign wealth fund, or they have not gone through the legal process of separating it. So that makes it even murkier. And so there's just a lot here.
Yeah, what a mess. I mean, you can imagine, too, if this deal goes through, is that, Newcastle United's sponsors for next season could be, visit Saudi Arabia or something. I mean, it's an opportunity for Saudi Arabia, the government, to go ahead and use Newcastle United to be on the world stage and give positive messages about the government. Whether it was we can go down the list, politically speaking, in terms of all the things that Saudi Arabia is doing. And at the same time, too, I can see why beIN Sports would be upset about this, because they're looking at Saudi Arabia, which not only is the country that has BeOutQ and seems to be funded by the Saudi Arabian government, too. So it's an initiative. It's a that the Saudi Arabians are doing it on purpose to go ahead and try to hurt beIN Sports, which are based in Qatar. And there's the political war, essentially, between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And beIN Sports has said, actually right before the coronavirus erupted, I had an interview with beIN Sports, in-depth interview, that talking about the issues of piracy. I haven't released that interview yet, just because of the timing of everything going on with the coronavirus. It's not a high priority talking about video piracy when there's no games going on. But they are waging their own war against piracy and trying to get sports broadcasters and in the NFL. It's not just soccer either. It's not even just beIN Sports' coverage of soccer. It's everything. So BeOutQ, if you're in Saudi Arabia or actually anywhere in the world, you can log into and see BeOutQ, the illegal station, and it has NFL, has golf, NASCAR. I mean, it has everything on there. So this one, you would think that the Newcastle deal will go through, Kartik, based on everything that's happened in the past from the Premier League. The Manchester City buyout by the Thai billionaire and all kind of the track record of things have been passed.
More recently, Sheffield United, right? Although I guess they were in the Championship at the time, they were in the Football League, but there are ties. Okay, so actually, if we want to talk about how it would be properly done, there is, I believe, a Saudi royal or someone connected to the Saudi royal family that has now majority ownership stake in Sheffield United, which is, of course, a Premier League club in the top half right now. So there might be a proper way to do this. At the same time, Chris, I have to tell you, I think Newcastle fans have suffered for so long. And I don't know that there's a group of football fans relative to maybe their level of expectation, their level of fandom, that have suffered as long in England. In other countries, there are clear examples. I would say Schalke in Germany, maybe the biggest one in the continent of Europe. But so I kind of want this to happen, even though I don't want it to happen, if you know what I mean, because I really feel like Newcastle fans deserve to be liberated from Mike Ashley. And it's pretty obvious in the past he will only take a offer well over the value of the club to sell. So I have to say I'm more torn about this than I thought I would be. If you told me 9 months ago, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund is going to buy a Premier League club, I would have told you, I'm adamantly against that. We got to keep them out. But because it's Newcastle, I'm feeling conflicted about this, because I really think that's a group of supporters that deserves something positive to happen.
Yeah, once the Premier League does come back, it's going to be a different world. And that goes for any league, Major League Soccer, Bundesliga, etc. It's going to be a different world because clubs will have less money. Which means that there's going to be issues with paying players. There's not going to be a big transfer window for any time in the near future where clubs are going to be splashing money around. You look at all levels of soccer, from the youth soccer all the way through up and to the top clubs around the world. there's going to be pullback. There's going to be less spending. There's going to be cutbacks. There's going to be layoffs. There's going to be big issues. And then you look at Newcastle United potentially going, this deal going through and being owned by Saudi Arabia. If the Saudis wanted to, even despite the current oil crisis, if they wanted to, they could pump, I mean, hundreds of millions of pounds into this club and be in the transfer market, be actually one of the few clubs that are actually splashing cash and spending some money, bringing in some top players. You can imagine, you can almost guarantee, Kartik, that the first move that they'll make is probably getting rid of Steve Bruce, bringing in some manager, I don't know, Carlo Ancelotti, who knows?
They're going to bring Rafa back, supposedly.
Bring Rafa back. Yeah, sure, why not? I mean, that would overnight would... you mean the Newcastle fans would love you for life overnight just based on that one move. And why not? I mean, go ahead and do it. And, I mean, in a couple of years from now, we could be talking about Newcastle United competing in the UEFA Champions League. And, I mean, it's happened to Manchester City. It's happened to Liverpool. It's happened to Manchester. You mean, you can go down the list in terms of all the clubs that have been bought out by foreign billionaires, you mean, or multi-billionaires, or in this case, governments, and yeah.
The only one that hasn't been among big clubs is Tottenham, which is mm-hmm. why, and Leeds. Well, I mean, Leeds is owned by a billionaire from abroad, but he doesn't. Andrea Radrizzani, who I know a little bit, lives in Miami, does not have the kind of deep pockets some of these other folks do. But every other club has been bought out. Everton, I mean, there's a lot of talk that Everton would be the next club to fall foul of financial fair play the way Manchester City and PSG have, because they have a billionaire foreign, again, Middle Eastern owner in Mashari, who has clearly overspent the club's revenues the last few years. Now, I think the way FFP is implemented is going to be very interesting after this, Chris, because I think whatever investment you have in football, given I think we all kind of understand the game is going to contract, the scope of the game is going to contract after this, I think it's UEFA has an uphill climb to say to, let's say in this case, Newcastle's new owners, no, you can't spend that money. You can't invest in your community. You can't invest in football, because I think it's the public opinion and the way people perceive these things would have completely changed after this crisis. I think financial fair play may be done at this point.
Yeah, I think so too. Out the window, because if you have a club that's willing to spend, hundreds of millions of pounds on players and to invest in the game, is that you're not going to say no to that at this point, especially even TV contracts too. The value of TV contracts going into the next rights cycle, and we know that the Premier League's ones coming up ends in 2022, as does Major League Soccer. It's at a time where a lot of TV networks are going to say, hey, you mean we took a hit in 2020. We're not going to have as much money to bid and spend on TV rights for 2022, unless, say, an Amazon comes in, or unless a Facebook comes in. But they may not want to do that either. So the likelihood of TV rights value going down is enormous, which means that if you have somebody that's willing to spend money, to put money into the game, you don't say no to that. So, yeah, I agree with you, Kartik. I think it's out the window there. All right, let's move on. The next piece of item is something we broke last weekend, and it is that Fox Soccer Match Pass, the streaming service from Fox Sports, will shut down on June 30th. Now, for those who may not be as familiar with Fox Soccer Match Pass, it began, I think it was 2010, as foxsoccer.tv. It was an extension of the website. It had some Premier League games, very little coverage, but it did have some live streaming of games. And at the time, that was really revolutionary. It was something brand new. It was something that Setanta was doing too, with Setanta I. But it was run about that time, so a really kind of a groundbreaking time. That evolved into Fox Soccer To Go, and then Fox Soccer To Go rebranded as Fox Soccer Match Pass. As of right now, Fox Soccer Match Pass has the Bundesliga and the Bundesliga 2 and some Major League Soccer games, And that's about it. Maybe
some rugby and stuff too.
Oh, yeah. Rugby, yeah, definitely. And I think AFL, like Aussie rules and things like that. But with the Bundesliga going away to ESPN Plus after the season ends, it would have meant that Fox Soccer Match Pass, even though it was priced at one of the most expensive streaming packages at about $20 a month, would have nothing really available for soccer fans. So it's closing down. If you go to the worldsoccertalk.com website on the homepage, it has information about getting refunds and also has a lot of information about canceling your account, step-by-step instructions. So check that out too, especially if you've paid for an annual subscription and you're not going to get that full year's worth because they're going to pull the plug. So go to that website and check that out.
Yeah, real quickly, when it first launched, it was revolutionary in 2010, and it had Liga 1, I remember. So I subscribed. It had Premier League leftovers. It had, for a little bit, some Scottish games. So there was some usefulness to it, and I want to say there were some other kind of international matches and things that would show up on there. And then gradually through time, it became less and less useful, honestly. So, but I give Fox props. I think it was they had the technology from Setanta to go, and they had replicated that. And then it was also the first service that didn't buffer too much. I mean, I think even in those days, the old ESPN 360 buffered an awful lot, and you'd fall fall 2-3, sometimes 5 minutes behind in games. I just remember Fox Soccer TV in the 2010-2011 season using it a lot. I was working for the NASL and was traveling a lot and would use it. I remember even using it at Fort Lauderdale Airport to watch an Arsenal Man City match, and the quality of streaming was far ahead of the competition. So I know we tend to beat up on Fox a lot, but I think this is another place where Fox was kind of ahead of it at one time.
Yeah, definitely in terms of the effort. There were problems throughout the times. I mean, the FoxSoccer.tv had issues. I mean, but it was a new technology at the time. The Fox Soccer – actually, I remember writing an article called FoxSoccer.tv Sucks, and it went through and it explained like a whole how I think like a whole weekend or two weekends of Premier League soccer, which some of the games were only available through FoxSoccer.tv. I mean, the service crashed. It was they were playing the wrong game, and I think shortly afterwards I got a phone call from Fox Soccer saying like, hey, we're really upset. Everyone in the organization is really upset about you and the article you wrote. And I was like, well, it's true. It does suck. It's like, you mean this, as far as a product goes, people are paying for this and it's not even working correctly. And then shortly thereafter, they changed the name of it. But yeah, it's, there's definitely a lot of, kudos that should be given to Fox for having it. But it's well past its sell-by date. For the Bundesliga fans, I mean, that was the thing that was a guarantee. You could get every single Bundesliga game and many of the Bundesliga 2 games on there. The issue, though, Kartik, is, you mean, if the season looks like it's going to start up on May 9th-ish, and if it won't finish by June 30th, what they'll do... Whether or not, I guess they're thinking that the season will end by June 30th and everything will be wrapped up. But if it goes past June 30th, I wonder if FoxSoccer.com might actually show some of the games that are for free, basically. Or maybe the Bundesliga would. Maybe ESPN would pick those up. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see what happens there. Last but not least, Kartik, on in the news section, this is that U.S. Soccer, the U.S. Soccer Federation, has been approved. They filed for a bailout, and it's been approved. They're going to receive a bailout from the government, despite having a cash surplus of reportedly as much as $140 million a couple of years ago. And this is something that these loans are supposed to be for small businesses. If you've been following the news, you know that a lot of major corporations have been gobbling up a lot of these loans that were intended for small businesses. And you had, was it Shake Shack this week saying that they had received a loan from the government for about $10 million and returned it. You had Ruth Chris Steakhouse that accepted the loans. Yeah. And now you have U.S. Soccer, reportedly, with a cash surplus of $140 million as of a couple of years ago, saying, yeah, we'll take a bailout from the government. What's your take, Kartik?
Yeah, so first off, I was real disappointed to hear about with Soccer America broke first, Brodeur at Soccer America, the firing of Brian Remedy and Tanya Wallach. I think this happened maybe before our last show, the night before, but we didn't talk about it because this bailout hadn't happened yet. I was really disappointed because there were a lot of people, I think, in the building there at Soccer House who don't quite get it. These are two of the people that did. I mean, I think Brian Remedy especially was always very approachable for people outside the kind of MLS Soccer United marketing family. But what you have is Will Wilson, former Wasserman, former Sum, former MLS, coming in now as the new Dan Flynn, and it looks like he's putting his imprint on the organization. So you fire two very competent, granted highly paid executives at a time when supposedly money's an issue. You've gone from $150 million or $140 million surplus in 2018 to this, where you've got your hand out for government loans at a time of economic meltdown. It's rather unbelievable. They've shut down the DA. My understanding, and I want to confirm this, is that there is some feeling that the Copa America 2016 money, which apparently was in the neighborhood of $40 or $50 million to the federation, is sitting in another account.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that's why the number is not – we can't reconcile the number. So if that's the case, and they're getting supposedly an annual $30 million from Sum, which is a lump sum, right? Includes whatever their revenue from the TV deal is and media partnership and maybe some sort of payment. I don't know, which is that might all come out in relevant sports lawsuits. They don't have very much revenue other than that, apparently, or so they claim. We've also got multiple lawsuits and obviously lawyers' fees we knew per the reporting of people like Brodeur and Paul Kennedy and Mickey Turner had already chipped away at their surplus. Jeff Carlisle of ESPN now reporting that they're happily taking government money right after they fire. I mean, I think the optics are horrible because they just closed the DA last week and they fired two highly paid executives ostensibly because of this. But now you're thinking they already took their cost cutting measures, right?
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do with this money. I do not assume it's invested back in the sport. They've already, you know, cut off their charitable arm, right? They're trying to keep that in-house. So just more bad publicity for them. I guess they don't care. That's the thing we've learned about U.S. soccer, that they generally don't care about the bad optics. I think there had been a change late last year, late in 2019, where Carlos Cordero was still the president. Brian Remedy was essentially filling the role of Dan Flynn after Dan Flynn left, and there was an effort to engage media. There was an effort to engage the public and fans in a way that they hadn't ever before. Now with Remedy gone, Cordero gone, Wilson and the MLS gang seemingly running things again, I think those days are done. They're going to be unabashed and unashamed of what they do.
Yeah, again, it's more examples of mismanagement by U.S. soccer, and this has been going on for years, as well as poor leadership in the situation that they're in with the lawsuits, with having a cash surplus, but maybe perhaps, like you said, Kartik, having some of these funds in a different account that they can't access. And then all the lawsuits they've had, and then now this news, now they're begging for bailout money, which they're getting from the government, which is effectively coming from us, the taxpayers.
And here's another thing. So I think we've taken some great pride in saying through the years, unlike other countries where football, soccer, whatever you prefer, is government subsidized or government funded, and football federations have government interference and have political ties. U.S. soccer has been very, very independent of government interference. You could argue, okay, there have been people who are political figures, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Donald Shalala, whoever, who've been very involved with U.S. soccer through the years. But generally, that's been the case. It's much more independent. And same thing with the U.S. Olympic Committee. Generally has been more independent than these federations, these governing bodies in other countries, including in some Western countries. Now, suddenly, I don't think you can make that claim ever again. That's another problem. That's another perception public relations problem down the road.
Yeah, and all of this comes back to television in a way with the TV rights Kartik, is because of the money that the US soccer is getting from not from say an ESPN or a Fox or one of those broadcasters, but from Soccer United Marketing, which is the marketing arm of Major League Soccer, which is the corporation, organization that does the TV deals. To get a TV deal for rights to U.S. soccer games, they combine it with Major League Soccer. And then some Soccer United Marketing says, okay, this is how much money U.S. soccer gets, which is approximately $30 million a year, even though it has the U.S. soccer rights in there, has the U.S. women's rights in there, which are increasing in value. And then you've got the Major League Soccer rights in there, too. So they've added that in, too. If you blew the whole thing up and said, okay, hey, Soccer United Marketing, thanks but no thanks. U.S. soccer, we've decided in the future we're going to go ahead and do our own deals, or we're going to have an agency that from the outside come in and do the deals for us. We're going to sell the U.S. women's rights to U.S. women's games separately. We're going to sell the U.S. men's rights separately. And Major League Soccer, thanks, but no thanks. But okay, you guys go ahead and sell those yourself and see how you guys do with that. My bet is that those rights, the value of those rights, would increase considerably. If you went ahead, and now you mean for U.S. soccer, U.S. soccer would get a larger amount of money coming in each month than what they're getting currently through some. Now, there's benefits of working with some in terms of the marketing, in terms of the events and the games, and having Mexico come and come over to the United States and play friendlies and things like that. But those are things that U.S. soccer could be doing themselves, or have an outside agency that's not tied with Major League Soccer doing that. So
even if they keep having some even if they keep having some doing this, I think the fundamental thing goes back to what you said earlier, Chris. If you split the packages, and even if some is the one negotiating the U.S. soccer package, it's just split, I think things are radically different. I think the bundling is even more than them serving as the marketing agency is the real problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, in all of this, Kartik, and this is a rumor, we have to say that this is a rumor, we don't have any evidence of this, but the rumor was that the reason that Carlos Cordero was gotten rid of within U.S. soccer and had to step down and had to apologize and then step down was because he was talking about perhaps having Soccer United Marketing not be involved in the next right cycle. Have you heard that rumor?
Well, I had heard that it actually, he may have had them involved, but he was seriously contemplating the split in the package. So they could negotiate the package for U.S. soccer. They'd be retained to do that, but that they would have to have a separate U.S. soccer package than MLS, which again, that to me, I guess would be okay. If it's true, what some proponents claim is that, IMG would never take this account, or Octagon would never take this account. Well, that may be true. It probably isn't, but maybe true. Let's accept that it's true for a minute. I think fundamentally, if you split the packages, maybe there's a little more transparency and honesty in this thing. Cordero, at the very least, from what I understand from multiple sources, was seriously considering pushing that potential, which obviously was not something MLS and Soccer United Marketing were going to tolerate conversation about. So Cordero's gone. They've got Wilson as the CEO, and I don't think that there's any threat of that happening now, right? Now I think they're safe.
Yeah. And it's, it's one of those things, though, too, that I think that Major League Soccer by itself could go out there to market and get a considerable amount of money for their rights and be self-sufficient in terms of having that. Combining that with U.S. soccer gives those rights more value, yes, definitely. And in the past, I can see why they did it, because the value of Major League Soccer rights, say, 10 years ago would have been very little. It'd been very difficult for them to get a large amount of money for that. So they combine it with U.S. soccer and say, okay, let's go in together as a partnership under Soccer United Marketing. We'll get more money and then we'll be able to spread the wealth. Okay, that's the past. As of now, I think it's one of those things that and we've called for this. I think you had an article about a year ago, Kartik, saying like, hey, it's time to split it. It's time to have U.S. women have an opportunity to go ahead and have their own rights deal, maybe with U.S. soccer or separately, where they can go ahead and get more value, and that money comes back more into the women's game versus right now, with the rights and the money that, say, Fox and ESPN and Univision pays Soccer United Marketing to have the rights to U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer games, that money goes into some, and then some within some, they spread that out. So some of it goes to U.S. soccer, a lot of it goes to Major League Soccer, and the women kind of get lost in the shuffle with that. So they're not, so that's one of the reasons that we brought up this this news item this week about U.S. soccer getting a bailout. It's a big story. And it's a story, Kartik, to be honest with you, that not a lot of people have picked up on. And you had Jeff Carlisle and Taylor Twellman from ESPN discussing it. But outside of those circles, you'd be hard-pressed to find much coverage or much discussion about this other than World Soccer Talk and maybe some of the social media accounts.
Yeah, and Soccer America, of course.
Right.
But yeah, there's very little discussion of it, which shocks me. I think it's just kind of an accepted. This is the thing that gets me, is that I think that there's a lot of anger about U.S. soccer, but it's anger in bouts, right? You don't have it sustained. And it seems like they still get away with an awful lot.
Yeah, yeah, and for many different reasons, because there's always the thought that a lot of U.S. soccer journalists who are, I mean, fearing for their jobs at this point in terms of, their employers, the publishers, do they have enough money to keep paying these writers? But even before that too, there's always kind of the thought that you had to toe the line, because if you didn't toe the line, there's the likelihood that you could get replaced. Within the U.S. soccer circles, it's a very almost like a boys' club too, where everyone is preaching from the same hymn sheet. Everyone is saying the same things, and there aren't a lot of people that rock the boat, because if you rock the boat, then you could be pushed out, or you could have your access to games held back. I mean, there's a lot of different things that can happen within that soccer industry, so to speak. All right, Kartik, let's move on to the listener mailbag. First up is Ritik, and he says, I highly recommend the documentary American Pharaoh. It was about Bob Bradley's tenure as the Egyptian national team manager during their 2014 World Cup qualification and the challenge he faced to unite a country that was dealing with a terrible political situation. Kartik, I've been watching this film this week on YouTube. It's available for free. And I think it was on PBS for a while, too. And yeah. I'm making my way through it. I haven't finished it yet, so I'll talk more about it next week. But did you see this one?
Yeah, I saw it when it came out on PBS. Yeah, you're right. Or maybe I saw it online. But it's fantastic, and it just shows if you don't already love Bob Bradley, you're going to gain an absolutely new appreciation for him from this documentary.
Next up is Vincent Orozco. Vincent says, I think you guys are mind readers, or I've been listening to the show for too long. The reason I say that is when I'm listening to your takes on the movies and books you recommend, they're so similar to mine, it's like you're reading my mind. Freaky. I love the fact you read emails from listeners last week. You got an email from Once in a Lifetime. I have a totally different take from the book and movie. In my opinion, we were so close to having the top league in the world. And in my opinion, if the U.S. would have gotten the 1986 World Cup, which went to Mexico, NASL would be here today. Do you guys agree? Because the U.S. audience would have seen Diego Armando Maradona at his best, and the 1986 World Cup revenues would have increased. I also think the league is making a mistake by not having a weekly highlights show. I'm almost 40, and when I was a kid, I wanted to watch This Week in Baseball and Inside NBA stuff on network television. It helped me become a fan of those sports. Thanks for all the work you do and put into the show. I really appreciate it. Wow, Kartik, there's a hot take. 1986 World Cup, which there was discussions. I mean, that could have gone to the United States. I think it was it Joe Avalanche that decided not to take it to the United States? And I think there's a political backstory on this one, too. And it went to Mexico, and NASL died. And it wasn't until, after the 1994 World Cup that a top-flight National League, Major League Soccer, emerged.
Yeah, I think there's a strong case to be made that NASL would have survived had the 86 World Cup been here, and the league would have maybe gone through some different incarnations, but it would have survived and would have been probably very successful. The thing I would caution, though, and I always caution this about people saying that the NASL would have been the top league in the world, or us saying now if MLS took the controls off, it would be the top league in the world. I think that there's not enough analysis of how the Bosman decision, the Bosman ruling, changed football in Europe, club football in Europe, and essentially football around the world. And maybe we mentioned this on the previous show here, but in fact, when I've raised the issue on Twitter, there have been some prominent soccer journalists who've DM'd me and said, you know what, that's a really good point. So I think the formation of the European Union, the EEC transitioning to the EU, meant the top leagues were always going to be in Europe. Once there was free movement of players within the EU.
Yeah.
But outside of that, I think NASL could have been the top league, which MLS is not. It is not the top league outside Europe right now.
Yeah, good points there, Kartik. You know what I would love? I would love for ABC or CBS or whoever has the rights to some of these old classic NASL games is to show one of those games on television. Show New York Cosmos against the Strikers or the Tampa Bay Rowdies, Rowdies Cosmos final, and show it on broadcast television or on cable television, and to see what the quality level was like and see some of these star players and just to reminisce a little bit. That'll be a fun time warp there. Next up is Bill Reese. Bill Reese says, regarding your comments last week on Grant Wall, it is worth noting for the record that Grant had nearly every candidate for U.S. soccer president on his Planet Football podcast in the run-up to the USSF presidential election in 2018. Even the lesser-known candidates such as Michael Winograd and Stephen Ganz. The only candidate I don't believe that he interviewed was Hope Solo. Grant is certainly known to be deferential in his interview subjects from time to time, but those who do not really make it to the top of their field like Grant has. And Bill, yeah, definitely good comments. My comments about Grant Wall were really focused on his role for Fox Sports. So every week he had, sometimes twice a week, sometimes on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, he would have about 10 to 15 minutes on the UEFA Champions League pregame show where he'd do a deep dive into the latest soccer news. And it was almost always news about Major League Soccer or U.S. soccer. And I think he did some stuff in addition to that, too, outside of the Champions League for Fox. And that was where, and again, too, this could be more Fox than it could be Grant Wall or could be the both of them together. But that seemed to be very focused on, when you were watching that, it seemed to be very focused on the establishment, candidates, and very little on some of the candidates such as Michael Winograd or Stephen Ganz or Eric Winalda or many others. It seemed to be very focused on Kathy Carter, on Sunil Gulati, on stories and narratives that were in favor of the establishment and continuing the establishment. And again, that could be more Fox Sports than it could be Grant Wall. We don't know. But that was my feedback on last week's podcast about Grant seemed to be part of the establishment, getting paid by Fox, and really kind of towing the party line and not being independent and not being somebody that was speaking his mind. It seemed to be that either by choice or not by choice, he was going along for the ride. And at that time, that was the time to stand up and to really take note and say some things that were important to the future of U.S. soccer, to say, this is awful, the way that U.S. soccer has been run, the team not qualifying for the World Cup. Here's an opportunity to change things. Here's an opportunity to go ahead and interview some candidates that had a different mindset, that had different ideas, that had a way of improving U.S. soccer that would have ramifications from the youth league all the way up to the professional leagues and the national team and the women's team. It's only since Grant has left Fox Sports has he seemed to have spoken up and start saying a lot of things that we've been wanting him to say, which has been critical of the way that U.S. soccer has been run. But at the time, the most pivotal time, he did not for when he was on Fox Sports. All right, Kartik, next up is RJ Hawkins. RJ says, great job keeping the show going through the global soccer shutdown. Belarus and Nicaragua excepted. It seems to be common knowledge that Major League Soccer teams have been directed to put off extending local TV rights packages past the 2022 season. With a new deal, do you think that the league will move to a more nationalized TV model with predefined TV broadcasting teams similar to Don Garber's one-time employer, the NFL? On one hand, it would definitely put announcers on site in every stadium, but it also allows the league to control image and narratives. And we've heard discussions. I think Kartik, you've heard this too. That inside, according to some of my sources, is that they're looking to have very much a, and this is before coronavirus, that they were looking to have a lot more control over the commentaries and over the talent that they had and over the things that they were they wanted to make sure the commentators weren't talking about certain things that could be controversial. They wanted to control that a lot more. Now with coronavirus happening, I'm wondering, Kartik, if that goes out the window and they say, hey, you mean this is going to be an expense or something that maybe we can't control as much. It's going to cost too much. And maybe it goes back to the broadcasters, the national broadcasters, and having them pick up a lot of the expense in having, you know, the talent go to the different games and stuff. What's your things?
Yeah, and local broadcasters too, because USL, by the way, the model that MLS, the rumored model, is the model USL has. And USL, every announcer is kind of derived from a central location. USL Productions is based in Fort Lauderdale. A lot of the announcers call matches off monitors. At times they're at stadiums. At times they go in and see the teams in person during training, but then come back to Fort Lauderdale and call matches. But they have a centralized location, but they do assign someone to a team, right? And they follow a team. They call a team through the year. I think that that has allowed USL, who is very – I mean, I've said this over and over again, and I think people who are just anti-MLS, they don't get it. And they're just very – they're very – myopic about any, you know, they support anyone who's not MLS, right? That USL is much more disciplined and scripted in how they present themselves than Major League Soccer is. And that starts with the local broadcast. That starts with the way local teams are allowed to present themselves to their local audiences. So I think Garber has seen what USL has done, and also what happens in other sports, as mentioned, and wants to replicate it at the MLS level, and it allows them to really kind of tightly control messaging. The question is now, with coronavirus, will they be able to do it? My guess is that they'll put it off further. I think this TV deal will happen. Local contracts will be extended. And it may be a project that they worry about further down the line.
Yeah, I agree, too. It's definitely an expense. But it is a way to control the message. Like, for example, I've heard from sources that worked for USL doing commentaries for them that they weren't allowed to mention the words NASL. They weren't allowed to mention that players, you know, maybe it was signed from an NASL club. They weren't allowed to mention any of that.
Yeah, you can mention those clubs, right?
Yeah, so it is a control message. And tighten it up a little bit and be very positive, which at the end of the day, the Kartik ends up being a little bit sterile. You mean almost unnatural, feels very just not propaganda, but just very, very sterile is probably the best word I can say. So
a lot of those USL broadcasts feel like that. And again, there are people who make their entire persona on Twitter or wherever just bashing MLS. MLS is, I mean, I have plenty of critiques of MLS, as I think anyone who listens to this show knows. MLS is not as scripted and as propaganda-ish as it could be. Just remember that. Check out some USL broadcasts sometime and then try and tell me that the MLS broadcast, the MLS announcers are less critical because they're not.
Wow, it sounds like George Orwell, like 1984 here in terms of even. Oh, my gosh. All right, next up is Paul Anthony Kelly. And Paul, this is a great question. This is a topic we could probably spend an hour on, but please give us your thoughts on the academy system collapsing. I'm from the side of things in saying that I'm not sure. I don't think anyone really knows yet until the next season happens and the shakeout from all of that. So a lot of the clubs that used to be DA clubs, not all of them are moving up to this MLS Academy system. On the girls' side, there are no there's no DA at all, and there's no MLS Academy system for the girls. So a lot of these girls' clubs will end up either joining ECNL or joining their own. I think there's supposed to be a talk about I think the DPL expanding. There's a lot of different ways this could go. I think it's too early to really analyze this in a lot of detail until we know how this whole thing plays out. But
I don't think ECNL has the administrative capacity right now to expand on the girls' side, which means DPNL is going to have to expand. I don't know, or some new league, some new entity is going to have to pop up. Although there are people who tell me consistently ECNL was maintaining a higher level of kind of development, at least for the college game, than the DA was on the girls' side. I don't know if that's true. But you might know better than me, Chris. But there are some people on the girls' side who tell me, you know what, the only problem now is a situation of capacity at the ECNL, because the DA wasn't producing quite the player, the level of player. And it would even point to the national team and say, hey, more recent additions to the national team have been, if you look back at their youth history, have been skewed towards ECNL more than DA academies, which I haven't taken the time to do that. So I just have to trust the reporters that have, and the people in the game that have. But that to me is a big question. On the boys' side, I don't know. The boys' side, I think it's I guess I'm more concerned about the girls' side because we're more competitive on the girls' side, and I think that there's been significant gains, and you even see this in women's youth soccer by the likes of Spain and the Netherlands. I mean, heck, the Netherlands got to the final, right, of the World Cup this time. So that the U.S. might be caught if this is not done properly. On the boys' side, on the men's side, I think player development has become such a mess in this country. I'm almost, part of me just wants to go back to the model where we have guys that fight like heck, you know, the Brian McBrides of the world and the Joe Max Moore of the world, and go to Europe and compete, right? And Clint Dempsey, and we seems like we were doing better than when we had a very structured, regimented system
for sure.
That seemed to take the creativity and the kind of fight and player and the discipline out of a lot of our guys.
Yeah, it's. I think it was Bruce Murray, who's the player for the United States men's national team, that made a similar comment to recently Kartik, saying that when I was playing, and there was no organized setup in terms of DA or any of this stuff, that we were still producing really, really good footballers from around the United States, and now you look at the level of quality level. And yes, there are some rising stars that are playing in Germany, but we've gone through. I mean, there's definitely a drop in the quality of the average American player.
Now, I don't. There's this kind of cognitive dissonance among U.S. fans that say, "Ah, this is the golden generation. These guys are better." Look, I would still take a Tony Sané over any of these guys.
Eddie Pope,
right? I mean, I don't. They've not paid attention to U.S. men's national team history and how some of our players developed. And I would take Greg Berhalter as a player over most of these guys. So I think we've just slipped badly. And I'm now at the point, even though people who follow me know that I talk about a lot of player development, I'm thinking maybe just let it go back to the way it was. And somehow we were able to always find 30 or 35 guys to be in a national team pool that were more competitive than the 30 or 35 guys we now have in our national team pool, coming from a very regimented system. And we have Pulisic. He is an exception to every rule going on now. So you take him out of the picture, and we are nowhere. If you just eliminate him, we are nowhere near where we were 10 or 15 years ago. That's the truth, in my opinion.
If you go back to Soccer Town USA, which is the documentary about Kearney, New Jersey, and the footballers that came out of that little town, and which is available for free on YouTube, the Tony Muellers of the world, the John Hawks of the world, Tab Ramos. They didn't go through a development academy or a pay-to-play system. They were just playing for the local team.
Right now, like Hawks, that's going to be trotted out in an FA Cup final. Do we have at Wembley? Do we have a single guy?
Right now? And the difference is that in this day and age, is that system has been monetized. I mean, that's the difference. It's not that the level of competition has been improved, or if anything, it's such a mess in regards to the way that youth soccer is set up. It's just a free for all in terms of just a money grab. That at the end of the day, the level of quality is not as good. It's just it's monetized better. All right, Kartik, last but not least, Raymond Roscoe says, my favorite football books are Why England Loses, Soccernomics. And if there's one thing that this pandemic has really pointed out about football and their owners is the profit margin of these teams and how they survive and razor thin profit margins. It would be really interesting to get Dr. Szymanski's forecast how this might affect European soccer spending and any of these teams are going to make financial fair play for decades to come. And that's true, Raymond. Absolutely. You look at Barcelona as one example, but a lot of these clubs, it's been 6 weeks without football, which means 6 weeks without money coming in from all levels of soccer. And you would imagine that most clubs would be able to survive that. Most clubs would be able to stay strong. And the reality is there's a lot of razor-thin profit margins. And clubs will be going out of business. We don't know. I mean, this talks about lower league clubs going out of business, but there will be bigger ramifications in the next few months. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, and Barcelona is a classic example. They've been living on the edge for however many years now, and I don't think that they. I don't think that they're a prudently run business, and it's almost like they're untouchable in certain elements of the media. So you have to be careful about what you say about Barcelona in particular, that club in particular, but they're not a well-run business. By the way, Dr. Szymanski is a Detroit City fan when it comes to U.S. soccer. So he's bought into kind of the whole aura around Detroit City and the supporter culture there, which is kind of cool.
More of an organic club.
That's why he's into it. Right. Yeah.
All right. So we want you to have your say. You can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. And thank you for sticking with us. It's been 6 weeks. Hopefully 2 weeks from now, soccer will return with the Bundesliga, knock on wood. And actually, at the top of the hour, Kartik, where we talked about what we've been up to, I didn't get a chance to mention that what I've been doing while we have had all this extra free time is I've worked on updating the YouTube channel. So if you go to youtube.com/worldsoccertalk, it has an archive of all the best episodes of not only the World Soccer Talk podcast. So every episode is released on there too. But we also have soccer documentaries going back from the one that you did, Kartik, with Josh on Tampa Bay Rowdies. We have, for the first time ever, it's been released today, actually, the documentary that Lawrence McKenna did for World Soccer Talk, which was on Opta Sports, where he went behind the scenes into the offices of Opta in London and filmed how they put together all of the stats for the Premier League.
Wow.
And like Opta Joe, that whole nerve center, and also did some interviews with some of the top folks at Opta. This was back in the time when Opta first launched, so it is a little bit dated. And we added some interviews too that Lawrence did with Patrick Barkley. Actually, there's a classic a piece of footage here, Kartik. And I think it's going to be released, I think it's this weekend, or it's going to be pretty soon. Every day we're releasing new content on the YouTube channel. It has video of you at the studios of Goal TV in 2006? No, 2010?
Seven.
Something like that, yeah. And it's you in right before Ray Hudson and Phil Shane go ahead and commentate a La Liga game. And you're standing in the corridor saying, okay, on this side of the corridor, we've got Ray Hudson and Phil Shane doing the commentary of La Liga. On the other side of the corridor, we've got the Spanish guys doing Goal TV commentary in Spanish for La Liga. And the footage isn't the greatest quality from back in the day, but it's and actually we get to step inside the booth to listen to Ray and Phil commentate a La Liga game. And the craziest thing is the size of the TV monitor. The TV screen that they're looking at is going to be like a 15-inch or 19-inch screen that they're like just trying to watch and do live play-by-play. Anyway, that's going to be on youtube.com/worldsoccertalk, if not this weekend, in the next coming days. All right, Kartik, thank you for listening. And you can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday on every podcast player, including youtube.com and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. And Kartik, heading into another week, what are you going to do for this next week? Anything you're looking forward to? And then what should the listeners do?
I'm looking forward to trying to get through more of Goldblatt's book, among other things. I mean, it's a chore, but it's well worth it. So for all of you out there, enjoy your football.